Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, Seth talks to the New York Times' Rukmini Callimachi, host of the captivating new audio series Caliphate. She also takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. Plus, journalist Sarah Kendzior talks to Seth about America's changing economy and continues the conversation backstage as well. But first, a closer look.
It's been 5 days since Rudy Giuliani went on TV and revealed that President Trump lied about paying hush money to Stormy Daniels, and they still don't have their story straight. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump's story about paying hush money to a porn star has taken more twists and turns than, well, a porn star. As you may recall, the president originally insisted that he had nothing to do with the payment, didn't know anything about the payment, and didn't know where his lawyer, Michael Cohen, got the money to make the payment. Well, Cohen himself claimed he never told Trump about the payment, and Trump never reimbursed him. Then, Trump hired Count Chocula's bookie as his lawyer, and he went on TV and completely blew up that story. Giuliani told everyone that Trump had reimbursed Cohen for that payment and that Donald Trump did know what it was for. And then the next day, Trump himself tweeted that Cohen had received a monthly retainer from which he entered into, through reimbursement, a non-disclosure agreement with Daniels. So that's where things stood as of Thursday. Then, for some reason, Trump talked to reporters on Friday and tried to walk back Rudy's comments, which he had already confirmed with his own tweets, by claiming Rudy didn't know what he was talking about.
I'll tell you what. Rudy is a great guy, but he just started a day ago. But he really has his heart into it. He's working hard. He's learning the subject matter. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Give the kid a break. He's only 73 going on Nosferatu. He's a former mayor and U.S. attorney who's now the lawyer for the president of the United States, and Trump talks about him like he's a trainee at Chipotle. Excuse me, my burrito fell apart. I'm sorry, he just started yesterday. He's a great guy. Rudy, you gotta tuck the tortilla. I'm sorry, he'll learn. He's a great guy. So Rudy, in an attempt to get Trump off the hook for possibly violating campaign finance law, revealed that Trump had lied, which Trump confirmed through his tweets, and then tried to unconfirm the next day. Of course, this is a no-win situation for Trump. Either he admits that he lied or says his lawyer is lying, which might be why Trump tried to claim that it was other people who were getting the facts wrong, without actually mentioning any of those other people by name.
Virtually everything said has been said incorrectly, and it's been said wrong, or it's been covered wrong by the press. It's actually very simple. It's actually very simple. But there has been a lot of misinformation, really. People wanting to say, and I say, you know what? Learn before you speak. It's a lot easier.
Learn? learn before you speak. You should learn to speak before you speak. Seriously, if it's so simple, then why don't you just explain it? Trump's only move when he lies is to lie so confidently that you'll think you're crazy. He even walks up to reporters like a guy who's about to lie. Okay. I can explain. Trump then stopped by the gaggle of reporters again and tried to claim that he actually hadn't lied about the Stormy Daniels payment when he said on Air Force One last month that he didn't know anything about it.
When did you change your story on Stormy Daniels?
We're not changing any stories. See, excuse me.
You did not know anything about the payment.
Excuse me. You take a look at what I said. You go back and take a look. You'll see what I said.
You said no.
Excuse me. Take a look at what we said.
Okay, let's all go take a look at what he said. So either he was lying then, or he's lying now, or that's really Alec Baldwin on the plane. Also, is it me, or does Trump always seem to say stuff that's incriminating while there's an engine running behind him? Trump's only gonna agree to an interview with Robert Mueller if they do it on a runway at LaGuardia.
So then Vladimir Putin said, oh, I guess so maybe that is collusion. That might be collusion then.
So Trump's official story now is that his lawyer got his facts wrong because it was his first day on the job. But hey, at least now we know Rudy Giuliani doesn't know what he's talking about and should not be trusted. I assume the Trump administration's next step was to make sure he never went on TV again.
Joining me now, attorney for President Trump and former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. Did you misspeak or did people not interpret what you were saying? Were you talking about the facts or were you talking about the law, Mr.
Mayor? I'm talking about the law and the conclusion. The facts. I'm still learning. This is, 1.2 million documents. I've been in the case for 2 weeks. Virtually one day in comparison to other people. So I'm not an expert on the facts yet. I'm getting there. But I am an expert on the law.
What are you talking about? Trump's going to be the first client who pleads insanity on behalf of his lawyer.
You have to throw this case out of court. The guy's a loon.
On Saturday, Giuliani also whined about what he claimed was the comparatively soft treatment that Hillary Clinton got, but did it in a way that, if I were his client, would not exactly inspire confidence in his legal acumen.
When you juxtapose that against the so-called investigation of Hillary Clinton, where she was basically given a warning, she deletes, she nice. Bleach bits, she, yeah.
Nice. Poor little Hillary. We got to be nice there.
I'm sorry, is he? Did he just pet his own hand? Rudy Giuliani is like a Bond villain who can't afford a real cat. Or he had a cat. I mean... he probably had a cat, and the cat was like, this guy's crazy, I'm out of here. Goodbye. Go to law school. And if you thought it'd be difficult for Giuliani to make things worse, he somehow found a way by waking up on Sunday and doing yet another TV interview, this time on ABC. Where he again seemed at a loss to reconcile his account with the various lies Trump has told. For example, last week, Giuliani told BuzzFeed that Cohen had complained to some people after the 2016 election that he'd not been fully paid by Trump. At some point, Cohen met with Trump and told him of his complaint. Giuliani said that Trump told Cohen, "We'll cover your expenses," and agreed to pay him $35,000 a month out of his personal funds over the course of a year-long period that began in the first few months of 2017. So the president was secretly reimbursing his lawyer for a hush payment to a porn star while he was in office. Because that's what you want the president focusing on. Mr. President, the generals think we should bomb Syria.
Wait a minute, is Syria the blonde? I liked her. But I understand these things have to happen.
So Giuliani's comments made it very clear that Trump was aware of the arrangement and agreed to pay Cohen back over the course of 2017, which means his comments last month on Air Force One, when he claimed he had no idea about the payment, were clearly a lie. And yet when Giuliani was asked on Sunday how his BuzzFeed comments square with Trump's comments, he stammered his way through an unconvincing answer.
So the president did know about this after the campaign?
Can't say that. I mean, at some point, yes, but it could have been recently. It could have been a while back. Those are the facts that we're still working on and that, you know, maybe in a little bit of dispute. This is more rumor than it is anything else.
But that's what you said. You said that to BuzzFeed.
But here's the well, yeah. I mean, that's one of the possibilities and one of the rumors. The reality is...
You stated it as fact.
Well, maybe I did, but right now I'm at the point where I'm learning, and I can't prove that. I can just say it's rumor. I could prove it's rumor, but I can't prove it's fact.
Man, you guys, this burrito is really falling apart.
Rudy, why do you have guacamole all over your face?
In fact, Giuliani could not seem to stop himself from blurting out embarrassing and potentially incriminating claims about the case. For example, he again repeated his argument that even if the money was campaign-related, it didn't violate campaign finance law, and mentioned that he himself has also made similar arrangements for his clients.
This was for another purpose, to protect him, to protect his family. It may have involved the campaign. Doesn't matter. And it would have been done under any other circumstances if there was no campaign.
If that's the case, then why wasn't...
And I can prove that it has been done on numerous times, not necessarily with President Trump, but with many other people that I and other lawyers have represented.
I'm sorry, I just need to point something out. What's with the diamond-encrusted pinky ring? Are you trying to look like a mob lawyer? I'm surprised he didn't do the interview in a velour tracksuit. If you don't want people to think you're evil, don't look like you're trying to collect all six Infinity Stones. But one of the biggest revelations from Giuliani in this interview was the admission that Cohen might have also paid hush money to other women on Trump's behalf. Giuliani was trying to claim that because this was a standard operating procedure for Trump and Cohen, it didn't count as a campaign finance violation. And in the process, he said this.
I did make clear, and I don't know what they are yet, I will know, there were other things involved that had nothing to do with Stormy Daniels. In other words, other amounts of money. This was not uncommon for him to do that. If I were him and I were the president's lawyer, and I had done this in the past, and it had worked out in the past, I would not go to him and bother him 2 weeks before the election with this thing.
You said this was a regular arrangement he had with Michael Cohen. So did Michael Cohen make payments to other women for the president?
I have no knowledge of that, but I would think if it was necessary, yes.
Oh, my God, Rudy, what is wrong with you? It's almost like he challenged himself to confess to at least one crime per interview. Soon he's just going to start cold-calling TV shows to tell them about illegal stuff Trump did. Hello, caller, you're on QVC. When Trump was a real estate developer, he took kickbacks from the mob. Also, how much is that pinky ring? With this episode... should make blindingly obvious, as if it hadn't already been obvious for years since he first claimed that President Obama wasn't born here, is that Trump and his inner circle are serial, habitual liars. They lie constantly, and they do it on purpose. This particular case is as clear-cut as you can possibly get. The media needs to just call these what they are, lies. If not, you're just doing this to Trump.
Nice.
This has been a closer look. Our guest is a New York Times foreign correspondent. She hosts the riveting new podcast, Caliphate. Please welcome to the show, Rukmini Callimachi. Welcome, Rukmini.
Thank you for having me, Seth.
So, we're three episodes, I believe, into your podcast,
yes.
Caliphate. This is inspired by your reporting that you've done on ISIS over the years.
It's actually my factual reporting, I hope.
Oh, factual.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
I hope so, too. But you... this is very interesting because you talk about this in the first episode, one of the major breakthroughs you've made in your reporting is going through the trash, be it Al-Qaeda trash, yes. Or ISIS trash in places like Mali and Iraq.
Yes.
And what is it that you found from going through the garbage of these organizations?
Well, imagine if I came to your house and I interviewed your neighbors mm-hmm. about you. If they're like my neighbors, they've probably never seen
you. I would like
you
not to do that.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. No, I'm actually planning to go and deliver a cake to my neighbors or like banana bread so that at least I can plant a story. God forbid anybody has to interview my neighbors. Right?
Oh, I see. Right? You want to do something nice to your neighbors.
I want to do something very nice to my neighbors because we always do this as reporters. We go to the neighbors and the neighbors know nothing, right, about people. Compare that to me going into your house and going through your bank statement, going through your diary, looking at your bookshelf and understanding what you read. I think it's a much more intimate look at a human being's life, the documents they leave behind, the objects they leave behind, than what we usually do, which is interview people about people.
And do you think they were aware when they left these places? Because in a lot of the times, obviously, they don't have a great amount of time to think or pack when you're ISIS leaving. That's what they say, the hardest thing about being an ISIS, no time to pack.
Exactly.
But do you think they were aware that they left behind a trove of documents that could be very useful to a reporter?
You know, when I was in Mali, I definitely, in one of the most important buildings, I found a big pile of papers, I think papers, outside that had been burned. I saw just the charred, you know, ruins of it. And people who were around there said that they saw them coming out with files and burning them. So you do assume that they've destroyed perhaps the most incriminating stuff. But they were trying to run a state. And the bureaucracy that came with that was just enormous. And so they don't have time to destroy everything. And what they leave behind is, in my opinion, very telling.
Another way you do your reporting and you actually interact with members of ISIS is you go on chat rooms.
Yes.
How did that first start? And how do you begin a conversation with someone from ISIS in a chat room?
It started...
Fair
question.
Yeah.
It started for me in 2012, 2013. That was the moment when, it was also the moment when Twitter was exploding. And there was a golden moment for, I would say, a year and a half, 2 years, when these guys were out there. They were all over Twitter, they were all over Facebook, they were on Tumblr, Instagram, and you could DM them and start a conversation with them. Most of them did not want to speak to me, so most of these conversations would end with them insulting me in some manner, or them trying to convert me. They were very intent on trying to convert me from my religion to theirs. But once in a while, you get through, and you start having an interesting conversation, you know, human being to human being with them. And I have found those to be very revealing. So once they left Twitter, Twitter started to crack down on them in 2014, 2015. They moved to something called Telegram. There it's much more difficult because these are secret chat rooms now. So you have to be invited by somebody that's on the inside. The code to get into these rooms is this long, you know, chain of gibberish. You can't guess it. On Twitter, I could guess who they were. And in these rooms, you have to be invited by somebody who is on the inside. I was invited by some of them at the beginning. Those people are no longer alive or whatever. And I'm now inside the chat rooms, and I spend a lot of my waking hours just trying to stay inside these chat rooms because they're being suspended every day.
Okay. And then now, are the people from ISIS now aware enough of your work to know that you're in their chat room?
Yes, they called me a spy. They called me, they have a bunch of names for me. Kafira, which is the female of kafir, meaning infidel.
Okay, that's nice. It sounds nice. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then another name that they have for me is Oink Mini Fat Machi. I'm sorry to laugh.
Wait, that's what ISIS is terrible at names.
Right. My first name is Rook Mini, so Oink Mini, like a pig. And my last name is Kalimaki, so it's Fat Machi. I'm sorry to laugh. But anyway, so I sort of feel like I'm in a room, you know, with like some of the mean girls from high school.
Yeah. It's weird that I'm surprised that ISIS can be cruel. I'm like, ISIS!
Exactly. I know.
I'm very disappointed in you, ISIS.
Exactly. I'm being fat shamed by a terrorist group.
It really leads to fantastic reporting, and I highly recommend everyone not only read your work, but listening to it is incredibly engaging, and the people you talk to are very engaging. You, obviously, there's a danger inherent to it beyond being trolled in a chat room. Do you ever take that into account? Do family members of yours ever take that into account?
So the FBI has come to see me and my editors three times now in, I think it was 2015, 2016, 2017. These are pretty scary encounters where the FBI calls the office and says, we need to see you immediately. There's what we believe is a targeted real threat against you. The first time they came to see me, it was a targeted threat against me, which you expect, and my husband, who is not a public figure.
Right.
We did a little bit of research, and we figured out that it was a member of ISIS who had infiltrated my Facebook account. Infiltrated is a bit too harsh. She had created a Facebook profile that was not hers, had friended me, and I had, you know, naively allowed her in as a friend, and she had then gone into my personal, you know, into my personal photo albums and started taking pictures of my husband and my family and sharing personal information about me online, right? So I ran home and told my husband, you and I are both, you know, the subject of these targeted threats because of Facebook. And he spent all night trying to figure out his Facebook settings, you know, to try to like secure them. And then he finally just unfriended me on Facebook.
Well, I mean, if there was ever a time to do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because I will say, my wife, I don't like all her friends, but none of them are in ISIS. Right. Hey, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
We're Greeny Kalamaki, everybody. Subscribe to Caliphate wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night, and here is Greeny Kalamaki, host of Caliphate, the New York Times' wonderful new podcast. I wanted to ask right off the bat, you've been a journalist for a long time. How did your storytelling change when you went to the podcast medium?
So I guess the biggest change is I've been in text now since the year 2001, right? So that's what, 17 years. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a print story, and especially when you're writing it for the New York Times, you're writing it in the third person, and there's a certain type of authoritative voice that you start to mimic once you join the Times. We call it Timesian voice, you know, and it's sort of this voice of God, this voice of you know, I'm very sure of what I'm saying. And in that rubric, you almost never break into the first person. I actually just did a first-person story for the Times that ran in April. It was my ISIS file story, yeah, about documents.
Really wonderful piece. Highly recommend it.
Thank you. And there was, and my editor and I were on the same page that it had to be in the first person because otherwise I would not be able to explain how I found these documents. But there was an internal discussion, and there was some hand-wringing over is that okay, right? Because you just don't do it. You just don't go into the first person in general because we don't want to. We're not trying to draw attention to ourselves. The story is the world that we're covering, not us. The beauty of podcasts is that the first person is just implied. I am in a hotel room and I'm about to interview a member of ISIS, and I'm there. And so it's clear that it's being told through my eyes. The point of view is clear. And the personal experience is clear because you're going through it with me. And that allows you to get behind the scenes on what is my beat. And my beat, I have to say, I've had probably a dozen beats as a journalist up to now. It's one of the most gnarly and ethically complex beats that I personally have ever been on. Every day you're dealing with these weird issues because these are terrorists. Yeah. And we're dealing with everything from how do you fact check their story to is just the fact that we're interviewing this person going to give them a platform, mm-hmm. to are we being too cozy with them? Are we humanizing them too much? Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing to be able to do that through audio because I feel like I'm able to take the listener through those problems as I am entertaining them.
Yeah, and you really feel that when you listen to the podcast. And I want to ask a little bit more about this idea of humanizing ISIS.
Yes.
Because that seems to be one of the kind of the goals of this podcast. Because the podcast starts with this question of who are we really fighting?
Sure.
So how do you try to humanize ISIS while also keeping front of mind what ISIS has done around
exactly.
the world?
Well, ethical conundrum number one.
For sure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I wanted very much to kind of try to pull back, you know, the curtain on who ISIS is. It's very, look, when we're writing about this group, because of how horrible they are, journalists, myself included, don't ever want to be in the position of having given these people a platform, having somehow justified what they're doing, and in any way helping, you know, their cause. And so it's very easy with that fear in mind to fall into this very black-white narrative. They're the incarnation of true evil. They're the boogeyman. They're psychopaths. They're crazy. But my experience in speaking to these people is, and I've interviewed between 2 and 3 dozen of them by now, in person, and quite a bit more online. When you end up sitting across from them, I'm always just dumbstruck at how normal they are, at how unbelievably normal they are. And that, in a way, is to me, it's almost more creepy than the notion of the psychopath. And I'll take you back to, I've had this realization before on a different beat. When I was in West Africa for the AP, I went to the country of Liberia. Liberia had under Ellen Sirleaf, the female president of the country, had passed probably the harshest rape law of any country on earth, where child rapists were going to get life in prison. and gang rape, with, if you prove child rape or gang rape, the two immediately were life in prison. And I got access to the prison where the first wave of rapists that had raped children were being held, right? They had already been convicted. And I had this idea in my head, you know, to me, like, what could be worse? Somebody who's raped a child. Like, who is this person, right? I was imagining a monster. And they brought out these guys, one after another. And I mean, you just struggle. Because in sitting across from me, there are these polite, pleasant, you know, just normal people. And then you sit there and you have such a hard time like squaring that with the evidence that is being presented. I literally went and found some of the girls that they had raped these children to make sure that this was right.
Really?
And this has just been a revelation that I've had doing this kind of work, where I think that we imagine them to be something very different from ourselves. And in fact, at least the ones I've met are not that different. And so then the puzzle becomes, what are the steps that this human being took? You know, what are the 100 or 200 or 10 steps that took this person from looking like a normal human being to doing these absolutely horrific acts?
Right. And you talk about the difference between humanizing and legitimizing.
Exactly.
And people kind of marry those, and that's they not do. Necessarily true.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also curious, just in terms of reporting out a podcast, we're 3 episodes in so far, there's going to be 10.
Yes.
How does the actual act of reporting change when you have to gather the facts and then also get into a booth and interview people and speak and edit and do all the things that maybe you don't have to do when it's just print?
Well, the main... One of the big differences between how I do a normal interview and how I do a podcast interview, when we're in the studio, first of all, you have limited time. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to book it, and there's competition at the New York Times because there's more shows being made, right, and there's the Daily. So you have limited time, whereas I'm used to...
Is the Daily just kicking you guys out all the time? Is Michael Barbaro just like, look, we're number one, everyone out of here?
Michael Barbaro has been incredibly supportive. It's more the other shows. I mean, it's just that we don't have that many studios.
Sure.
They keep on building more, but as it is,
it's a print publication.
A print publication. Yeah. We have a couple of studios. They're not that big, and there's more bookings than there are, you know, time available. So having these meandering interviews that I typically have, where my technique has always been to just let people talk, to not interrupt them, to not do this kind of aggressive back and forth.
I also
with them.
Just wanted to...
No, yeah, sorry. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. To not do that.
Exactly.
Because I feel that as they get more comfortable with me, then they kind of let down their guard and they begin to speak more honestly. That is a nightmare for audio, because you then come home with hours and hours of tape.
Yeah.
And you need that nugget. You know, you need the soundbite, right? You need that. You need the person to say the main point that they are making in a couple of sentences. Boom. And if they say it all over, it really becomes difficult for you later on. So in radio, what you're doing a lot is you're asking people, okay, you said XYZ. Mm-hmm. Could you try to rephrase that to be a little bit more succinct? You know, you're actually prompting them to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to ask is, you talk about how much you love this beat you're working on. It is so, as you said, gnarly and dangerous, but also exciting. Yeah. Do you ever look at the people writing in other sections of the New York Times and just wish, oh man, I wish I was in real estate today, or science, or tech, or politics? Or do you truly love the challenges of this job? Or are there moments where you're like, oh man, I would just love a column in a...
I mean, I don't love how little attention international news gets these days compared to politics.
Yeah.
So I do look longingly sometimes at my colleagues, you know, on the Washington beat.
Yeah, Trump tweet will always get more coverage than almost anything else in the world.
Yes, exactly. As far as other beats, sometimes I look longingly at people that have something that is quite well prescribed and small.
Uh-huh.
Some of the best stories that I remember, a correspondent who in the year, I think it was like 2003 or 2004, was covering an election in Togo, of all places. And it was Brian Mueller. He's gone on to write, you know, amazing books and everything else. But among my favorite work by him were these little, they were like miniatures, you know, these little 1,000-word stories on the Togolese election, where there was all the drama of, you know, the president who's trying to hold on to power, the president's evil advisor who goes around with a little dog under his arm. And that, to have this very small terrain,
Because my terrain is like all over.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like I'm in Iraq.
By definition.
You know, by definition. I'm in Paris, you know, mm-hmm. 1 month. I'm in Iraq the next month. I'm in Niger another month. That makes it hard to develop really, really deep sources, yeah. right? Because you're bopping around. Whereas if you're in like this little smaller place, that also is attractive.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congrats again on the podcast.
Thank you, Henry.
Such an incredible listen. I highly recommend everyone subscribe.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it was such a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Our guest tonight is a writer and journalist whose new book, The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America, is available now. Please welcome to the show Sarah Kendzior, everybody.
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So this is essays, a collection of essays you wrote from 2012 to 2014. Mm-hmm. A lot of what you were writing about seems to me to be the things people are writing about now after the election. You were sort of there first. You were visiting the places and writing about things like the failure of institution and increasing paranoia and media bias. And in a way, predicting that there was fertile ground for a candidate like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Do you take any solace in the fact that you called this?
Oh, no, not remotely.
No solace. Okay.
No. When I'm in demand, when my areas of expertise are in demand, then you know America's in bad shape.
So. Right, exactly. When Sarah's here, it's bad news.
Yeah.
You talk about this idea of parachute journalists. You live in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. You come from the Midwest that had such a hand in making this choice for this president. So when you talk about parachute journalists, what do you mean? Do you mean the reporters from places like New York and Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, you know, journalists from the coast who come into the Midwest, usually with a kind of preconceived narrative in mind, who want to talk about the mystery of, you know, why are people rising up in Ferguson or why did Trump win the election? And they stay there for, you know, a few hours, maybe a few days, come back, write the declarative story about it. And it's often very, very superficial, very misleading, and it really does do damage, I think, to national discourse.
And when you're someone who is a journalist who is living in St. Louis, when you read those articles, is it frustrating to know that no one will really call them out on it?
Yeah, well, I call them out.
But, right.
You know, but yeah, I mean, it's frustrating because people are genuinely suffering. You know, we have serious problems everywhere in America does. I'm not limiting this just to where I live in the Midwest or St. Louis. But when anybody treats your community with that level of superficiality, with that lack of concern, you know, come in like it's the Hunger Games, treat you like an object, it's insulting wherever you are. And it's a shame because, you know, local journalism really has been gutted. And I think if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't necessarily have this problem.
You know, the book is about the forgotten America. You talk about the election talks in the post-election analysis. A lot of it talks about the forgotten people that helped Trump get elected. Is there, and you speak of the danger in calling anyone forgotten. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, Trump likes to bandy that phrase about forgotten people. I mean, he's, you know, I think a better phrase would be neglected people, because that puts some accountability on public officials. You know, they have a job. Public officials are here to serve us, whether they believe so or not, and they've been negligent. I think that that's, you know, somewhat true of the Obama administration. It's certainly true of the Trump administration. They're negligent with malice, with malicious intent. And so this idea that Trump somehow speaks for forgotten America or speaks for people in places like where I live, it's absolutely ludicrous.
You don't feel like, thanks to Trump, you guys are remembered now? You don't feel like the remembered people?
we're the blamed people. yeah. You know, although, he, you know, he came out of here. He's a product of, you know, New York kleptocratic mafioso.
Wait, you know, are you putting him on us?
No, I'm not blaming. It's nothing personal.
No, I think it's a...
I think it's a collective shame, you know?
Yeah, exactly. we do share him around, all of us, yeah.
I'll pass him your way.
Thank you. So, you also speak about how, you know, after we had this recession in 2007, 2008, you know, obviously there was part of that crisis was very real, but there was also a part of that crisis that was manufactured and limited the personal recovery of regular Americans. What did you mean by the manufactured crisis?
I mean, the crisis is real, and it was geographically unequal. And this is something that Trump, you know, unfortunately did understand, is that, you know, in the heartland, outside of these sort of rich coastal enclaves, you did have real pain. You had a lack of jobs, a lack of opportunity, an inability to get by. What corporations did, though, is take this idea of the recession and of the recovery and basically just decided to stop paying people. That's something I discussed quite a bit in the book. They had unpaid paid internships, unpaid labor. They made that kind of a normal expectation, even though it's extremely exploitative. And it became a restructuring. You know, they said, oh, it's the recession, we can't afford it. Oh, it's we're still recovering, we can't afford it. And they did that as a way to, you know, limit the labor pool to the most elite, to the most advantaged. And that, you know, creates problems. As they say in the book, a false meritocracy breeds mediocrity. And unfortunately, I think we see that in our political and journalism.
Yeah, I think so, too. So you actually, you know, you have a PhD. Mm-hmm. You know, you obviously had come from the part of academia where people would say, oh, this is an incredibly qualified candidate for employment. But you found that that is actually can be a barrier as well to have gone through academia the way you did.
Yeah, I mean, I got a PhD. I studied the former Soviet Union. I studied authoritarian states.
So I just want to make sure, your PhD is in authoritarian states.
It's in anthropology. It's in political anthropology. I studied how dictators use the internet for propaganda to manipulate trust.
To
self-expression. I studied Uzbekistan in particular, you know, just this dictatorship ruled by this very kleptocratic leader who abused government privileges to enhance his personal wealth, had this fashionista daughter who was always getting involved in state affairs. I mean, you know, nothing obviously to do with our current climate.
So I imagine when you were doing this, people were constantly like, Sarah, what are you going to do with your Uzbekistan education?
Yeah, and unfortunately now we know. I came out of academia. You know, I started in journalism. That industry collapsed. I went into academia. That industry collapsed. And now I'm in the sort of collapse industry where I study how things collapse. Academia is another industry that has this, you know, systemic labor exploitation. And I think you see that in almost any intellectual field, in policy, in academia, in media, in entertainment. You know, these are problems that we have. And what I don't like about it is it locks out a lot of talented people, especially mm-hmm. young people, you know, who are trying very hard, who've gotten all this education, taken on all this debt, and they don't have anywhere, you know, to go and express what they're able to do.
So you study sort of this dictatorial Uzbekistani regime.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump shows up. How quickly in his campaigning did it look familiar to you?
Instantly. Okay. Instantly. I thought this guy is going to rule like a Central Asian autocrat, like a kleptocrat. I mean, and you know, I have to say, Trump is an American phenomenon too. You know, we have predecessors, we have demagogues, we certainly have racist demagogues. But the idea that his primary goal is going to be to make money, things that he does like inserting his family into the campaign, inserting them into the administration. And of course, you know, it became kind of a literal thing of being tied to the former Soviet Union when he hired Paul Manafort, when all yeah. of his ties with Russia were revealed. Then I was like, you know, what the hell is this? This is like when I had one of those surreal 2016 moments where I'm like, did I die? And like literally every horrible thing I've ever studied has collided. and now finally I have a job opportunity. Like, this is not how I wanted it to turn out. So, you know.
Well, we're lucky there was someone who was at least had the tools to write about it. You do write about complaining.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think a lot of people now, you know, would say we're doing too much complaining.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of write a celebration of complaining and how it is a useful tool and, you know, a wonderfully democratic tool.
Yes.
So what is your, to explain what you love about complaining.
Well, complaining gives you a chance. You know, what every social movement, you know, started out as somebody complaining and that complaint getting dismissed. And, you know, I get frustrated when I see people's valid complaints dismissed because it's often a form of compassion. You know, you're looking out for other people. You're complaining about unfair circumstances. And I think when you say to someone, oh, stop complaining, that's an assumption that their social position is more important than that person's pain. And so I encourage everyone to complain, particularly under this administration. You know, let your feelings be known. And, you know, on a serious note, I do study dictatorships. I have friends who've been locked up for having the kind of conversation that we're having right now. It's nothing to take for granted. Freedom of speech is absolutely nothing to take for granted. Social justice is something that we should fight for. So if you can speak out, you absolutely should.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm sure he's at least looked into locking us up, just so you know.
I believe he's outright said it. I mean, you know, I'm an enemy of the people. I'm a member of the opposition party. He and Bannon, I mean, they've been very explicit. And, you know, we have a different society, obviously. We have a tradition of free speech, an expectation of free expression. Technically, we have a constitution that's supposed to be followed, although apparently Trump and his cohort think they're immune from it. But, you know, I do worry about these things changing. You know, I don't take any opportunity to speak out, especially on the behalf of somebody more vulnerable than me, in a worse situation than me. I never take that for granted.
So I want to ask about the one thing that seems the saddest to me is, you know, you talk about all these sort of root issues that were in this country and that Donald Trump used to get elected, and yet Donald Trump now has become this sort of daily circus that those root issues are now exactly as ignored as they were before the election.
Yeah. No, that's very frustrating to me, too, because whatever happens with Trump, those systemic problems are going to be there. And, you know, I think what's happened is now we have problems we never thought were coming. Now we're, you know, wondering if we wake up in the morning, like, will Guam still be there? Like, we're worried about nukes. We're worried about Nazis. But underneath it all are, you know, systemic racism, economic inequality, you know, media bias. All the things that I discuss in this book are there, and they've been exacerbated. You know, Trump and the GOP are stripping away the social safety net. People who were having a hard time, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, are having a much worse time now and are probably in for worse times to come, you know, unless we do fight this administration. You know, we're in a flawed democracy that's moving to a burgeoning autocracy. And, you know, I'm obviously very concerned about that.
Well, I have to say, it's really was fascinating to read a book that is so much about what's happening now that what took place before now. And it's wonderful writing. And it was just great having you here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Give it up for Sarah Kendzior, everybody. The View from Flyover Country is available now.
Hey, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Sarah Kendzior, author of The View from Flyover Country. So as you were talking to Seth about, this was a collection of essays you wrote between 2012 and 2014. It was an ebook, and now it's an actual book. How depressing was it to kind of sift through these essays twice? Because these are about pretty serious, challenging issues in America.
I mean, each time it was very depressing. It was depressing to write them. It was depressing to put them together in 2015 because these issues were still there. And, you know, the work, unfortunately, had not gotten dated. And then the fact that it's still that way in 2018 is depressing. But these are systemic problems. You shouldn't necessarily expect them to change overnight. But the fact that they've gotten so much worse under Trump, that these concerns have been sort of brushed to the side a little bit, you know, concerns me.
Right. And you were chatting with Seth, too, about the idea that Trump ran on these issues. And it's a terrible irony that he ran on these issues, kind of exploited these issues. And now we don't talk about them in any sense.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you get distracted in some sense by the spectacle. You also have much more severe problems, you know, like possible looming wars. You have, you know, a rise in neo-Nazi and hate groups, all these other things. But, you know, Trump doesn't care. He's never cared about these issues. The only things he's done to places like the Midwest is bankrupt it, you know, like in Gary, Indiana. He does the same kind of, you know, schemes that he's done all over the world. And it's unfortunate because some people really did buy into that.
Yeah. During the 2016 election, of course, you wrote about many systemic issues that were behind the scenes in the race. And, you know, I think there's a lot of focus on Trump when you read this book. But Hillary Clinton cited your book, or was it this year?
Yeah, she quoted it. Yeah, last year.
What did Hillary Clinton say, and what was it like hearing her response to the book?
I think she was talking about healthcare and about the GOP's attempt to take away Obamacare from people. And, you know, I'd had a section about, you know, stigmatize those who, you know, want people to die, not those who are struggling to live. And so she liked, you know, that passage in particular. She liked the book. I was just kind of startled. You know, I was in Germany at the time, and suddenly my phone started blowing up, like, you know, in the middle of the night. I'm like, what the hell is this? And then I'm like, Hillary Clinton. And, you know, it was really weird. And, you know, but I'm glad at least, you know, that sentiment resonated with her and with the other people, you know, to whom she was speaking at the time.
Right. No, it's fantastic. I also wanted to ask, you have a section in the book about malls, shopping malls. Can you kind of talk through the role malls have played in America and how their death is celebrated by some, but it really is kind of a tragic thing that we're seeing happen?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in one of those towns, you know, like a Bruce Springsteen town where like the downtown is completely boarded up and dead. And, you know, the mall was where all of commerce moved to. And now, you know, for my children, they go to the malls in St. Louis that, you know, you've got grass growing through the parking lots, you've got abandoned stores, and you've got just, you know, it's another sign of an economy that's changing much worse for laborers, because, you know, people think the mall is superficial, it's chain stores, it's commercials, you know, it supplied jobs and it's not being replaced by anything. You know, we have this problem of automation of the internet, quote, disrupting the economy, but not in a way that's actually beneficial for people. And so, you know, we have a whole restructuring that I don't think the government or anybody has really grasped in a meaningful way to improve people's lives.
It's interesting you mentioned disruptors, because that really is celebrated, the idea of disrupting industries. Mm. How do you disrupt industries but do it in a productive way? I mean, that's a difficult question to answer, but I'm wondering how you kind of have those conversations where you can disrupt, but it's not going to take people's jobs away and hurt local economies.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, we need disruption because we have a very corrupt system. So in some sense, we know we need transparency, we need accountability. But, you know, I've been frustrated by the digital revolution because you just see this conglomeration of wealth in a few cities. Whereas, you know, with technology, it should be an industry that could benefit you anywhere. That's where how I thought it was going to end up in, you know, 2000 or something when I looked to the future. But you don't see that. Instead, you see whole regions that don't have broadband, for example, that can't participate in the economy, and, you know, a kind of lockout and a real apathy. So I think, you know, what you need to do is look at, you know, who is vulnerable, you know, what areas are lacking employment, what skills do people already have? There's always this assumption that people don't have jobs because they don't have skills, but it's often they don't have money. They don't have the wealth to do unpaid labor for a job. They don't have the wealth to get a credential that they don't really need, but, you know, technically need to get the job. That sort of thing is incredibly frustrating to deal with.
Right. That gets to one of the major themes in the book, is this idea of barriers to entry, that there are many more barriers to get into these high-paying jobs than many people may realize. And one of them is journalism.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how the barrier to entry in journalism limits the types of stories that are ultimately told?
Yeah, I mean, right now, one out of every four journalists is living in New York, LA, or DC. And that was not true. You know, a decade ago was bad enough. It was one out of eight. And, you know, but you go back further and you had this, you know, rich, diverse kind of news environment, not diverse racially, not diverse in terms of gender, but at least in terms of geographic location. The country was being covered. Now it's not being covered geographically. You have a real imbalance in things like op-eds. 80% of op-eds are written by men. You know, you have a very low percentage of Black and Hispanic correspondence. You know, you have just situations, like, imagine if we had a more equitable conditions, like, how would Flint be covered? How would these things that are massive ongoing daily crises for people be covered? They would not be ignored. And so that's frustrating. And a lot of that is the product of this, you know, you need to get a $60,000 MA in journalism, and then you need to do a couple unpaid internships. And that's all considered normal. But for the vast majority of this country, they can't participate in that. And telling the stories of our lives is something that anybody should be able to do. This should be like one of the least elite industries if we're really going to do justice to democracy.
Right. Do you think about publicly funding journalism? Is that kind of a solution there? Is
this government publicly funded? So I don't know what that... yeah. I mean, Trump's like, yeah, let's do it, you know, propaganda state. I mean, that's part of the problem is under a democracy, a true democracy, that's not a bad idea.
Sure.
Because it does, you know, ensure that certain topics will be covered. It makes up for things financially. Under this government, I wouldn't trust it. You're going to get like a Sinclair type situation with a bunch of people reading a script about freedom of speech simultaneously, like little robots. But yeah, you know, it's frustrating because I think journalists should serve the public. You know, public officials should serve the public. That's not happening in any sense. And some of this is choice on the matter of these media industries. They could pay reporters more. They could diversify their staff. They could have people situated in other parts of the country besides these cities. I don't know why they don't. It makes overhead cheaper. It's way cheaper to live out where I do and see St. Louis and, you know, other cities than to live here in New York. So I have no idea why they do it other than to just reinforce this elite standard, which is pointless.
Right. Well, we are very lucky that you were doing the work you're doing and that you were able to compile this collection of essays into a book. It is really a gripping read and highly recommend it. So thank you so much for being here and thank you for writing this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, me too.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.